Rob Mahoney of The Ringer talks Jazz and the Western Conference. This is Roundball Roundup on UtahJazz.com. I'm JP Chunga on the Utah Jazz Podcast Network, presented by First Colony Mortgage, the official mortgage lender of the Utah Jazz, and MLS number 3112, Equal Housing Lender. Rob's one of the good guys. You look at the Jazz, wouldn't say that at this point on national NBA podcasts, they're in the path of totality. But for the Ringer NBA show, at least for one show, they were. They do a bit that I am absolutely jealous of. It's called Say Something Nice About the Bottom Five. They do it for the Western Conference. They do it for the Eastern Conference. They did it for the Jazz. And one of the most astute observations was made by Rob. So I had to get him on, talk about the West, heading into this last week of the season. He's insightful. He watches. He's a good dude. Support him over at the Ringer, Ringer NBA show. He's on group chat. He's the foremost expert on Fargo. But support the other shows too. It's a good site. Anyway, enjoy Rob Mahoney, Ringer NBA, here on Roundball Roundup at UtahJazz.com.
Yeah, honestly, the bottom teams in the West, not so hard. The bottom teams in the East, a bit of a struggle. And that, you know, that's kind of where the league finds itself right now. But it's something we like doing and that we've been doing for a couple of years now, kind of as a send-off for these teams that we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about over the next couple of months as we get into the NBA playoffs. And so it's a nice time to check in with some prospects who are getting burned on teams like the Jazz for maybe the first time all season, or at least getting more consistent burn for the first time all season. And also just to take like a, you know, a state of things for all of these rebuilding clubs, whether they're kind of tanking their way into those spots or they're trying to come up and failing, or maybe they've had injuries all year they've been dealing with. But it's good just to kind of take stock of those teams, even as we're squeezing in God knows how much Lakers talk or Warriors talk along the way.
One of the things that you said nice about the Jazz was surrounding Taylor Hendricks, somebody that is very, very highly thought of by Jazz fans and by people who are watching the team. What did you notice about Taylor, and why was he the thing that you wanted to note when you said something nice about the Jazz?
Yeah, I would say deservingly so in terms of being exciting and highly regarded among Jazz fans. To me, he's one of the highest ceilinged players on the Jazz, and the runway could be a little bit longer in terms of fulfilling everything that potential could be. But the combination of having all of these really exciting and really encouraging defensive gifts and a defensive intensity that I really appreciate, along with some mechanisms to get him on the floor in the shorter term and in the medium term. You know, as someone who, I don't really follow a lot of college basketball, so my familiarity with a lot of these guys is once they get to summer league or once they get into preseason or once they get into their NBA teams. I knew he was a three-point shooter in college. I was not familiar with the ease of that shot for him and the comfort of that shot for him and the fact that he's coming into the league and hitting corner threes in particular, just like a blistering rate. That's the kind of thing that if you're an exciting young prospect, and even if you're considered a project player in some ways, you can be on the floor if you can hit that shot. And so that gives you all sorts of really interesting developmental opportunities, no matter what the future of the Jazz looks like. Like, there's a room for a player like Taylor Hendricks out there. And once you get out there, then you get to see everything he can do defensively. You get to see him guard Anthony Edwards. You get to see him try his hand with Luka Doncic. You get to see him try to figure out Victor Wembanyama. And like, that's what you want in a young player, is what are the opportunities for these guys to get out there? And Taylor Hendricks has lots of avenues to do that.
How valuable are these minutes towards the end of the season? Because he wasn't playing necessarily NBA basketball until the trade deadline. It was a lot of him playing in the G League, learning and wetting his beak, so to speak, towards NBA schemes. How valuable are these minutes now? I even think back to the first game that he played with the Jazz starting. It was against Kevin Durant and the Phoenix Suns, and his first action on the floor was blocking Kevin Durant. That was really cool to see the potential that he could have as a defender.
Yes, and honestly, I think it's even more valuable defensively than offensively, because yes, it's useful to get used to the cadence of the NBA game on offense and the spacing, kind of what your spots are on the floor with your teammates. I think what's hard for the Jazz right now is a lot of these players are not in their usual roles. They're missing so many guys out of the lineup. And so it's hard to even know, is this going to be my exact role going forward? Whatever changes are made in the offseason, where would that even leave me in terms of what my future role would be? But what doesn't change is your understanding of NBA personnel. And this is something that a lot of young guys talk about when they come into the league. And, you know, playing a player like Kevin Durant the first time versus the second time and the third time, and you get a sense of, oh, when he goes right, he loves that hang dribble pull up with this kind of timing, and you can sort of sense it out. And you can see Taylor Hendricks learning in real time with a lot of these plays. He's already pretty dogged trying to fight through screens, for example, but you get a better sense of how to fight around a Yusuf Nurkic screen the more you play against a guy like that. And so all of those opportunities to not just get on the floor and get NBA minutes against NBA competition, but play against specific NBA threats. And that's what's interesting about him as a prospect, is he's not just the guy you're putting on the court. He's a defender you're throwing into the fire against the most difficult defensive matchups. And those are the guys you want reps and opportunities to see up close.
What's a high ceiling for him, thinking optimistically of what he could be in the league?
It's kind of dizzying to think about. And depending on how you want to frame it, it may sound like fainter praise than it is. But when I think about Taylor Hendricks, what I think about are who are the most dynamic combo forward defenders in the league? And who are the guys who have that skill set and could also have the ability to stretch the floor? And beyond that, the ability to build off of that shot and hopefully get to the rim more consistently and hopefully diversify some of his offensive game. When I think about his defensive potential, I look across the league at a guy who right now plays very limited minutes due to injury in Jonathan Isaac with the Orlando Magic. But if he played more, would be a first-team All-NBA defender. And that's the kind of like package that Taylor Hendricks has, is he could be one of these apositional 6'9 guys who just can guard everybody and can bind a defense together and could be a good switch defender and a good show defender and a good trapping defender and a great one-on-one isolation defender. And at the point where you can do all of those things, you're putting a lot on the table for your team. And if he's doing that and doing, I mean, frankly, he's already a better shooter than Isaac has ever been or ever will be probably, that's a fascinating player to think about. That, I mean, that's a potential star in his role, if not an out-and-out star in the traditional sense.
Keontae George is another rookie that people look at here and are really enjoying watching. What have you seen from him, and as somebody that was on a different path than Taylor in that he was playing at the start of the year?
Yeah. I mean, he's just such a natural shot creator, and the efficiency isn't always there right now, as is the case with many young players, but the instincts are there. So I love how comfortable he is with the pull-up game. I love the prospect of what he could be as a playmaker. And we don't know yet, and we're just kind of seeing glimpses of it. And obviously, he's kind of on the ball and off the ball almost in equal measure, depending on who he's playing with. So it's tantalizing to see him with those opportunities. But that's kind of what you always want to see with these sorts of scoring guards, is how much could they be on the ball? Can they be a lead guard at a high NBA level? And with Keontae, the scoring is there. As I'm saying, the scoring instinct is there, and the pull on defenses is going to be there. But can he learn to manipulate it? Can he learn to manipulate defenses with the threat of his shot to get to the basket more consistently or to set up his teammates more consistently? And he's on a great track as far as that goes. And if he gets the opportunity to do it, I'm eager to see where exactly he can grow into a more sophisticated passer. But that's a challenge. Like, that's a hard thing for young guards to do, to look at the game and learn to read it, not just for how do I get into my stuff and to the things that I'm comfortable with, but how do I make everyone around me more comfortable too?
And that's the thing that's been missing from the team post-trade deadline. It's why Kelly Olynyk not being on the team is so impactful. They're lacking playmaking.
Yes.
And putting Keontae in those situations now, he's going through the struggles of, you're seeing him turn over the ball, but isn't that a part of the development curve for young guards in this league?
100%. And not just guards, but you'll see a lot of even bigger wings be put through their paces in that way too. This is what this time is for. It's for the basketball to be a little ugly sometimes, for there to be some turnovers, in the hope that you get used to the rhythms and the reads and what your opportunities are in those scenarios. And it takes time. And sometimes it takes coming in at the end of a regular season in particular, although he's been playing longer, but a different look here at the end of the regular season, and failing in certain ways, losing some games, missing out on some opportunities, putting a lot of mistakes on film that you can then review with your coaching staff or with your trainers independently and figuring out, what do I do better and what do I take into the offseason to actually make that happen?
His pairing with Colin Sexton in the backcourt might, I don't know what your opinion of Colin Sexton was heading into this year, but for me, it's definitely changed in the way that he's played as of late. How have you evolved, if you have, on Colin Sexton, and what is the future of this sort of pairing that they're playing towards the end of the year?
Well, I think Colin Sexton has evolved, to be fair. And I think our understanding of him has also evolved along with that. But I'm sure he was given a raw deal in some ways, as a lot of these sort of bucket-getting guards are. And this is one thing I think about with Sexton, and really any guard who goes out there and gets buckets, is who are the guys who settle and are stepping back, are fading away, are being rebuffed by defenses and still shooting, and by virtue of how many shots they take, they get points, versus who are the guys who get to their spots? And Colin Sexton gets to his spots, right? He is one of the most dangerous players in that kind of high paint floater range area. He's so comfortable there. And it's because he has the strength to get there. He has the body control. He has the touch. And so when you are putting up points and you're proving valuable as a scorer to your team, regardless of, you know, if you're a pure point guard, whatever position you're playing, all that stuff is kind of very fuzzy and malleable to me. Are you creating value for your team by getting to the places you mean to go to? And Colin Sexton does that. And so then the question is, what is his best role? What kinds of players do you want surrounding him? And the pairing with George is so interesting in that way, because I think what makes George a fascinating prospect is he could be on the ball, he could be off of it, he could be more of a combo guard. Maybe he ends up being a great full-time starter. Maybe he ends up being a great sixth man for a really good competitive NBA team. We kind of don't know what his role is in a good way, in a way that opens up possibilities for the Jazz. And so between the two of them, you have a lot of flexibility and you have a lot of options as far as how you want to be playing these guys and with whom, as you figure out what the future of the Jazz is going to be.
Now let me tell you about First Colony Mortgage. They've been serving the lending needs of Utah for more than 35 years. As a mortgage banker, First Colony Mortgage offers advantages over other lenders. Not only do they process mortgages, they also underwrite, fund, and close mortgage loans all in-house. Their expert team is ready to help you with your home financing needs. Just check them out. First Colony Mortgage, the official mortgage lender of the Utah Jazz. In Fargo land, Minnesota, they're number one in the West. What is your confidence around that team when it comes to postseason basketball?
It's a tough question to answer because I think I would have answered it pretty differently before Karl-Anthony Towns' knee injury. You know, tearing a meniscus is a pretty serious thing, and there's some early reporting and buzz that he might be able to get back even before the playoffs start, which would be great for Minnesota. The problem with that is the role that Towns plays, especially in, they have so much size in Utah, you know, playing with Gobert, trying to make all this work and that kind of spacing work, puts a lot on Towns to solve. It's his job to adapt defensively and chase guys around. It's his job to attack in space and be a dynamic player off the dribble in ways that Rudy is not and will never be. And so if he's doing all of that on a surgically repaired knee, working his way back into the lineup in playoff basketball, that's tough. That's a tough situation to be in, no matter how much respect you have for their defense, no matter how much respect you have for Anthony Edwards and how explosive he can be in any given game. It's just a lot to put on Cat right now. And so I would have loved to see the fully healthy and rolling version of their team get into this. But as it stands, I think they're going to be tough. And they've proven, even in his absence, to be much tougher and resilient than even I probably would have expected. I thought they were going to have a significant drop-off offensively without him. But they've been one of these teams all season that basically never loses twice in a row, that always bounces back, that always has an incredible, I mean, this is a Rudy Gobert staple as much as anything, but an incredible amount of pride in the way they play. And so between the experience and the pride and the discipline, I think Minnesota is going to be very tough for a lot of teams to play against. But they're unquestionably more vulnerable than you might expect of a top-seeded team in a conference as good as the West right now.
That's the thing about the Western Conference and why I really understand the step back that the Jazz took at the trade deadline is how difficult it is to compete in this conference when everybody in the offseason got better. Like Houston signs Fred VanVleet.
Yep.
And they immediately get better. Dylan Brooks got better. It's difficult to see where the Jazz hang out in their neighborhood, which right now is a play-in team.
And the sheer numbers game of that, where even if the Jazz had gone full steam ahead and tried to make the play-in, just the fact that there's going to be 12 teams fighting for that spot effectively.
Yeah.
Like, you may only end up a couple of games out of 7th or 8th place, but that puts you in 12th. And you know, what do you do with that if you pushed all in at the end of the day? So it's going to be interesting over the next couple of years as franchises get used to navigating the idea of the play-in to figure out when they decide to scale back and when they decide to push forward, because the cadence of the NBA season is changing because of it.
Oh, yeah. And it's been a great addition in terms of excitement.
No doubt.
It's why Houston losing yesterday to Dallas is so crushing. I wanted to see them push Golden State to the final week, and they almost did it, but it was good to see them go on the long winning streak and
yes,
make it interesting at the end.
And the way that the play-in creates these tiers, too, I think also makes a lot of these end-of-season games fascinating to watch, because it's not just can you be the Rockets and punch your way into the play-in. It's if you're in the 9-10 range, like the Lakers and Warriors are right now, can you edge your way up into 7-8 and get yourself like one more chance to get into the playoffs? Like, that's a huge difference for these teams, whether you're a young team that's inconsistent. Like, Sacramento's a great example. They've shown that they can lose to almost anybody over the course of this season. If you have guys out, if you're a bad opponent, like bound for the lottery, the Kings can lose to you on the wrong night for them. Or, on the other end of the spectrum, the Warriors have been so up and down, and they're just like an inconsistent team because of the way that their offense functions. And so, whichever situation you find yourself in, you want two shots at it, and to have just the one do or die where every game puts your season on the line. It's an incredibly difficult way to play basketball.
No margin for error for the Lakers or Warriors in that 9-10 right now.
Definitely view them as the favorite. And that's something I think you hear as you talk to players and coaches around the league, too. You know, especially these teams who are in that like 6 to 10 range, who are trying to figure out if they can make the playoffs and if they do, who they would play against. There's a pretty much unanimous chorus there that anyone but the Nuggets. You know, we'll try our hands with the Timberwolves. We'll try our hands with the youth of OKC. And that's a smaller team that some of these other kind of contenders and teams that are vying for play-in spots might be feel like they can bully and attack on the glass and make some kind of inroads. But when Denver's healthy, there's not a lot of ways to match up with them. And the health is going to be such a crucial thing for that team. You know, they did lose a little bit of depth in the offseason when they lost Bruce Brown. And over the course of this year, we've seen all of the repercussions of that. If they have their top five guys on the court and they are carrying the bulk of the postseason minutes, they can beat pretty much anybody. But if Kentavious Caldwell-Pope turns an ankle, you know, if Michael Porter Jr. misses a couple games, if Aaron Gordon, who is an incredible athlete, goes up for a lob and has a tough fall, all of those things could put that team on the ropes because they just don't have the depth to make up for it. And so they are as rock solid as any Western Conference team can be right now, but even they feel like they could be one bad break away from their whole season unraveling.
Are the Thunder a team that a playoff squad would want to play?
Here's the thing. I think they do. And some of that is the reputation of what young teams do in the playoffs, teams do in the playoffs. There's this idea that historically those teams underperform. They win 50-something games in the regular season. They get into the bright lights of the playoffs, and they just can't quite deliver in the same way. They can't quite replicate the magic of what they did in the first 82. I would be very hesitant if I were a play-in team to want the Thunder. because you watch them play, and I'm sure there will be ways in which their young guys get a little bit daunted by the pressure of the playoffs and the intensity of the matchups and the way that everything is just schemed tighter to exactly the opponent in front of you. All that's very true. But that's a young team that always plays within itself and that doesn't make a lot of mistakes. And guys who, they stick to the script and they know their roles and they're incredibly unselfish. All of those things I think are going to translate pretty well. And so you think about a young team. I don't think about Chet Holmgren as being a piece of a young team in like a very traditional sense. Like that guy has far outperformed anything you would expect of a rookie. And that's going to be the back line of their defense and the back line of a defense that's been formidable all year. So I would say try your hand with the Thunder at your own peril. That is a very talented, very effective, very well-coached team, and they're not going to be fun to play against.
I also get very worried if I have to play in the first round a top five player in the NBA.
Yes.
And the Thunder have that with Shea this year. He's unbelievable in the way he attacks the paint. I get worried if in a first round I have to say I have to stop that guy for four games. That's a tough ask in a playoff series.
Well, especially when so many series kind of follow the corollary of who's the best guy on the court.
Yeah.
And can he control the game? And with Shea, he has no problem controlling the game. And he controls it sometimes in a pretty unconventional way where it's not dominating the ball in the way that Luka Doncic might. But he comes and goes within the offense. It's such a drive and kick informed system. But he fits so seamlessly with all of these guys in ways that allow Jalen Williams to cook, that allow Josh Giddey to find his spots, that allow, you know, new Thunder Gordon Hayward to pick his spots here and there. So the way he plays facilitates all of those things. And the fact that he can be the best guy on the court, he can put up 35, he can hit a game-winning shot because he's so good one-on-one and so shifty, and at the same time not take anything away from anyone who's playing around him, it's an incredibly powerful thing to have in a playoff series.
Outside of the top four, is there a team that worries you the most in the Western Conference?
Worries me in what sense?
That they could make it to the Western Conference Finals.
That team for me is Dallas.
Yeah,
I think that's the one. The only question would be the matchups. And this is where Denver's placement in the standings gets really interesting. Because right now, you know, Oklahoma City's just barely behind Minnesota and Denver, who are effectively tied for first and second in the West. Mm-hmm. If Denver ends up in first place, all of Dallas's plans probably go kaput. But right now, the path looks like Dallas will play the Clippers in the first round. That's a series I think they can win with how well they've played since the trade deadline, with how great Luka has been, with how impressive their defense has kind of corrected its season as they've gotten healthier and with these new additions. I think they can win that matchup. And if they get through the Clippers and they find the Timberwolves on the other side of it, or even the Thunder on the other side of it, that's a competitive series. That's one where maybe Dallas has the argument that they have the best player on the floor in any of those given series. If for as good as Shea could be, you know, Luka could outperform him. We've seen it before. We've seen him show up in those moments before. And if you win that, all of a sudden you're in the Western Conference Finals. So in the East, there's a very distinct, like, you need to dodge the Celtics as long as possible to try to just survive thing going on. In the West, it's not so dissimilar with the Nuggets. I think as long as you can stay on the opposite side of the bracket, you're going to be in at least competitive shape and give yourself a chance to punch your way through. The problem is no one knows where the Nuggets are going to be between first and third. So good luck trying to scheme out the rest of your season and decide, oh, do we want to rest our stars this night or lose this game strategically? There's no way to game the standings right now.
And they've got Minnesota on Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the game. That is the game that determines the pecking order of these things. Are you worried about LA's defense? Clippers, the Jazz played there on Friday, and it's never good when, at least now, you're in a stat with the Jazz defensively, because it's them, it's Toronto, and then the Clippers, at least as of late, when it comes to defense.
Quite a sobering statistical framing for the Clipper defense these days. You know, teams on double-digit losing streaks at that time, plus you. And I know the Clippers, they've been without some of their key guys. And I think what's worrying for me with them is the players who have been critical to their success are not just good NBA players, but they're critical to like getting the energy level up. It's Russell Westbrook coming into the lineup and giving the team some life. It's Norm Powell coming into the lineup and juicing things and getting guys involved and getting guys energized. And if you're a veteran team with the hopes of contending for a title right now, I would hope that energy would be the least of your problems. This is your time of the season to show that, okay, we can get a rhythm going into the playoffs. And I've seen very few actual signs of life from the Clippers. So you never want to rule out the possibility of a flip being switched with a Kawhi Leonard team. But we don't really know how healthy Kawhi Leonard is going to be and how available and how active he's going to be when he's actually on the court for them at this stage. So there's a lot of questions with them that I don't think any of us would have anticipated based on how well they were playing in say, January. Like, they looked like the best team in the West then, and now they absolutely do not.
I'm so dumb guy brain that when they got Harden, I said, you know, this might work, because my big complaint about L.A. was they needed a point guard, and James Harden was a point guard, right? Like, he knows how to play this position. Maybe this solves things for them. And that was my dumb guy brain take on them acquiring James Harden.
I mean, if that's the dumb guy brain take, it looked very smart for a very long time.
Still a dumb guy.
But even then, like, everything we're talking about with them is all about their defense.
Yeah.
Is James Harden a bad point guard for them? Although he struggled in his own ways. But offensively, they can work. But are they going to guard people? And I think what's worrisome about the Clippers, too, is the way they defend is such a high wire act, where if they want to play smaller, or even if they want to play bigger, like Ty Lue, the strength of his coaching is throwing out unconventional pressures, unconventional schemes, things that take a lot of mental acuity and focus to execute. And if you're not on a string, all connected, and let me tell you, the Clippers right now are not very connected, those schemes are going to fail. And so that's where they find themselves as these playoffs begin, as a team that is a little disjointed, is pretty out of sorts, may or may not be healthy, and just has not been able to defend basically anybody for months now.
Most interesting thing you are watching this last week of the season is?
I'm very curious to see how this play-in stack winds up sorting itself out. Because, you know, not to circle back to the Lakers yet again, but this is a team that does get a lot of national attention. Obviously, any team with LeBron James on it is going to be a figure of interest. But if they stay in the 9-10, and let's say the standings maintain more or less as they are now with the Sacramento Kings in the 7-8 game. The Kings swept the Lakers in the season series. Domantas Sabonis has been very successful playing against Anthony Davis. If it ends up where the Lakers win their play-in game and then have to scratch and claw with the Kings for the chance to make the playoffs, I don't care how badly and how inconsistent the Kings have played at times this season, that's a great matchup for them. And a great matchup that could be one of these very sobering moments for all of these big national narratives and all of these huge stars and all the financial interests in getting the Lakers into the postseason. I think the Kings could just smack them in a game like that. And that's the kind of thing that would be very dramatic and very fun to watch, especially during a stage in the season where we're not used to having those things. You know, maybe in the before play-in times, there's some seeding battles. Maybe someone's fighting for a scoring title. But this sort of like winner-take-all type mentality of a game like that, that's the kind of thing we love to see. And that's the way that the NBA is kind of drafting in a little bit of the urgency of, you know, the NCAA tournament in terms of this single elimination format with some of these play-in games.
Sacramento last year, looking at cleaning the glass, 119.7 offense. That was first. And this year, 117, and that's 14th.
Yeah.
What do you think explains that?
I think there's been a little bit of regression. I think they've been in a weird stretch where if you look across their roster, it's not a lot of guys who are old and who are in points of their career where you would expect regression or expect them to start fading. They've just kind of plateaued individually in a lot of different ways. And I say that even as Domantas Sabonis is breaking the all-time record for consecutive double-doubles. I say that even as Malik Monk, prior to his injury, was having a great year. But then you look at Keegan Murray, you look at Harrison Barnes, you look at Kevin Huerter before his injury. It's a lot of guys who are promising or talented or valuable, and yet there's just been something missing with them all year. And now they're in a stretch where, because of their injuries, they're having to play more defensive-oriented players on the perimeter. You know, guys like Keon Ellis and Davion Mitchell, who are good NBA defenders. But at the same time, like, that takes away from what you do offensively. And so I think, for one, teams are just more used to the way they play now and to the Mike Brown offense. There is a comfort and a familiarity to the flow that wasn't there last season. But also, it's just hard to perform and deliver again after the big breakout, right? There's the season where everything comes together, and then you wake up and you have to do it all over again. And that's a tough mountain to climb for the second time.
tell people all the podcast, everywhere they can find your work.
Come listen to us at the Ringer NBA show. I'm, as we said, I'm on group chat, but there's a whole lineup of shows for you to check out. I also cover television on the Prestige TV podcast. But really just come to theringer.com, read all our stuff, check out the various podcasts available to you. I promise if you're interested in something sports or pop culture related, we have a home for you somewhere.
You're listening to this, I'm sure you will like listening to Rob on those shows. Check him out. He is on The Ringer, Rob Mahoney, on Roundball Roundup on UtahJazz.com. Rob, thank you so much for taking the time.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.